Hey guys, my name is Alex, and you're listening to the Thousand Movie Project podcast. I thought everything was fine. When I showed up to work at the grocery store yesterday, I was sweaty, as usual. Back in February, Marie and I moved to an apartment that is exactly 1 mile away. That is exactly 1 mile away from the store. Not that far at all, still walking distance, but it's quite a stretch from the previous apartment, which was like 4 blocks away. And even though we are now twice as far as we were last year, I still have not quite gotten into the habit of just leaving the apartment a few minutes earlier. Every day, pretty much, I show up to the store the way I showed up yesterday, which is to say panting and sweating. It was 2:03. And when I clocked in, yeah, I got a dirty look from one particular manager, but he always gives me dirty looks. And I walked to the computer and I clocked in. And then I went to the employee log, which is a handwritten thing on the wall, to see what was my first task of the day going to be. And when I looked for my name and I traced it across the spreadsheet to 2 p.m., I saw that the 2 p.m. box, where normally there's a little color-coded smidge of highlighter indicating you're either on the cash register or you're working in one of the aisles, in that 2 p.m. box there was no color at all. It was white, and just sort of penciled into the center of it was the fateful letter M. Because at this store, the letter M stands for meeting. President George W. Bush, who to this day is considered the most physically fit president to ever occupy the White House, you're welcome, allegedly used to hold meetings with his cabinet members where no chairs were allowed into the room. And his thinking behind this was, if everyone is physically uncomfortable, if everyone's back is hurting, then what is normally an hour-long meeting or a 20-minute meeting, often it's boiled down to like 3 minutes, because people just speak their piece and then they move on. Not only that, they're more inclined to compromise if they know it will get them out of this physically uncomfortable situation. I'd heard that years ago. A number of people have brought it up to me, the almost morbid efficacy of it, citing it as an example of weird human quirks that like a master businessman, a master leader, can manipulate in order to sort of nudge their followers in a preferred direction. What I have subsequently learned is that this is not true. It never happened. He never did that. The protocol for meetings at the grocery store is you find the manager who wants to speak with you, and you follow them through the store, out through the back of it, into the alleyway, where in a dark, recessed corner, there are 2 overturned milk crates that are designated for face-to-face sit-downs, out there in plain sight of any employee who might walk by, but just outside of earshot. The manager who met me out there was Emil. Emil is Mexican. He's tall, with a shaved head and a goatee. He is very friendly. He jokes a lot. And right now, as he and I are, we're in the moment here, as he and I are sitting across from each other, I can tell that he's nervous. He's talking a mile a minute about a bunch of different things. He's got my file on his lap and he's squeezing it shut like he's afraid a sin might come flying out of it. Emil hasn't been at work for a while. The reason he's been gone is because one night last month he woke up from a bad dream and he tossed off the covers and, realizing that he was awake, started screaming. His wife took him to the emergency room, and when he got to the counter to explain that he was just in some amorphous, stabbing, debilitating pain, they told him that they simply had no rooms at the moment. He would have to wait out here in the lobby for a while. They directed him over to some chairs. He couldn't make it all the way there, and so he laid down on the floor in front of the desk, and he just stayed there, moaning. New people came in, they stepped over him or stepped around him. After a while, a custodian came by with a Zamboni, and he squirted the floor around Emil and then cleaned it, so that there remained, on the floor of this hospital lobby, right at the front desk, a fetal-shaped dry spot the size of a 42-year-old Mexican man. About 4 hours later, a doctor and a room became available. They came out, they put him on a stretcher, they ran some tests, and then they sent him home with painkillers. That night at home, he went pale, he curled up on a rug, and he turned feverish, so his wife figured we ought to go to the hospital, but she didn't want to risk getting stuck in traffic, so she called 911, an ambulance showed up, a paramedic came in, knelt down on the carpet, checked him out for a minute, and said, yeah, you got appendicitis. From there, they took Emil to the hospital, and when they wheeled him into a room and a nurse came and heard his symptoms and looked him over, she just sort of nodded soberly, and she said, yeah, you got appendicitis. And again, Emil thought maybe he was dreaming, like everyone's suddenly taking him so seriously and sounding so certain. And he said, why do you say that? They didn't say that to me at the last place. And the nurse nodded, and she said, lucky for you, this is not that place. And then she pressed down on his abdomen, and he screamed. And at this particular hospital, they ran the same tests as the last hospital, and they found that his appendix had burst. They said he was a couple hours away from sepsis, maybe death. So what Emil is doing right now is he is suing that first hospital. So it's now about 2:05 p.m. It's maybe 90 degrees outside. There's a very light drizzle falling sideways through the alley. And Emil and I are sitting on overturned milk crates in that little recessed hovel, talking about his pending lawsuit. Emil talks for about 15 minutes before finally lifting both of his palms, like he's bracing himself for something. Now, your file got slid up to me today, and we gotta talk about something. And he took out a small stack of papers, and he turned them toward me. There were weird numbers and, like, jots of text that I couldn't make sense of. Most of them were highlighted. He said, so, 2 minutes, you know, here and there, that's not gonna throw the whole store out of whack. If anybody had told me, as he and I were sitting down, that I was habitually late and that it was a problem, I would have rolled my eyes. Because yeah, now and then I show up 2 or 3 minutes late, whatever. I still work the whole shift and I jump right into a task. No one is left languishing for my tardiness. But to be presented first with the data before getting the lecture, my offenses seemed a little more substantial. Turns out, I have been late for almost every single shift. Never once have I arrived more than 5 minutes late, but very seldom have I arrived less than 2 minutes late. There was a trending story from the New York Times last week about what they're calling a pandemic of absenteeism in public schools around the country. The article focuses on one particular school in Colorado, which I guess is supposed to look like High School USA, where absenteeism is keeping with the trend of the US public school system insofar as it is 30% worse than last year. One of the school psychologists speculates in the piece that all these kids calling out of school is a manifestation of students' anxiety. The fact that their anxiety is off the charts. He mentions that some of the more troubled students are having outbursts 20 times a year, whereas last year maybe it was 5. Fistfights, for instance, are way out of control. And he says that this new sort of post-COVID anxiety, it probably has something to do with kids having spent one random year taking classes online from home during the sort of peak COVID period. And then if they passed those classes, which everyone admits was not that difficult to do, and then they showed up for classroom sessions the following year, having been promoted to the next grade, a lot of those students found themselves underprepared. And his theory is that this new wave of anxiety, this dread of being unprepared, it's triggered a kind of fight or flight response among students, and the fight part manifests in these classroom outbursts, the literal fist fights that are going on throughout the building, and then the flight part manifests in staying home. Most of the work that they submit is posted online anyway, and even their classwork is largely accessed in web portals while they're sitting in the classroom. As a school counselor argues, these kids might be getting their assignments done when they stay home from school, but they aren't building relationships. They aren't learning how to be a person among people. They aren't seeing and accommodating people's differences. They aren't learning to control themselves in a communal space. It's a really interesting article, but it felt lopsided because one of the unmentioned reasons for high school absenteeism is the fact that high school fucking sucks. My memory of high school is just a fog of pimples and algebra and erections I couldn't explain, and it came to mind yesterday as my manager, Emil, was asking me if there was anything going on in my life that was keeping me from making it to work on time. If maybe I would like to have my schedule tweaked to 2:30 instead of 2. I had to say something in this meeting, and so I agreed that yeah, it's probably better to just scoot my schedule, make it so that I clock in at 2:30. Because the alternative is yeah, I could sit here and I could pledge to you, I could do it face to face, eye to eye, I could put it in writing that I will make a concerted effort from this point forward to be mindful of the clock and to leave my apartment by 1:30 so that I get here every day 2 minutes in advance of 2 p.m. But the fact of the matter is, I should not be in the habit, nor should they expect anyone to be in the habit, of confronting problems and choosing a solution that would force me to become a more responsible person than I am. Not that you shouldn't make that leap now and then and try to better yourself, try to be more punctual, try to hold yourself to a higher standard, but it's one of the great luxuries of adulthood, it's one that you do not get in high school, to acknowledge when you have become a bit of a problem, when you're not meeting someone's expectations, and then you get to make that liberating decision. Do I make myself rise to these expectations, or should I instead try to reduce my life's strain by bringing the expectations down to where I already am? The latter is not a glorious choice. It might not seem like the most noble one. They call it adding by subtracting. Sometimes the way to sort of become a better version of yourself is not to tackle on more responsibilities, cultivate more skills. Rather, it's to subtract some of your obligations, reduce some of your expectations of yourself, and encourage other people to reduce some of the expectations they have of you. But you need to know your priorities before you can make that decision. And in order to know what your priorities are, in order to know what you value, and by extension, the kind of person you need to be, you need some alone time. You need time to yourself, time to think. And the way to get that time is to fucking not go to school today.